KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, we'll have a conversation all about obesity with local pediatrician researcher Robert Lustig, who has a new hypothesis about what causes the high rates of it in children and what to do about it. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Last week, UCSF pediatrician and obesity researcher Robert Lustig published a new hypothesis about obesity in Nature Clinical Practice, Endocrinology and Metabolism, based on obesity studies conducted between 1994 and 2005. Dr. Lustig hypothesizes that processed foods full of sugar make the body believe it's hungry. Sugar makes more insulin, which block hormones that tell the body to stop eating. And Dr. Lustig sees, in effect, a poison food supply, or what amounts to a poison food supply, altering the biochemistry of our brains and accounting to a great degree for the child obesity epidemic that has been advancing steadily over the past three decades. Joining us for this morning's second hour here in studio is Dr. Robert Lustig. Good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Krasny.
Well, where do we begin? Let's begin talking about how we're going against the first law of thermodynamics here, I mean, as you see things.
Well, the first law of thermodynamics, as stated by scientists, is that the total energy inside a closed system remains constant. There are two interpretations of the first law. Now, the standard interpretation that everyone out there normally thinks of is, if you eat it, you better burn it, or you're going to store it. In that case, the energy storage becomes a manifestation of two pathologic behaviors, that is, gluttony and sloth. And therefore, it's very easy to blame the obese person for being obese because, after all, this is clearly a behavioral aberration. This is a character flaw. It also makes sense economically because the government is not ready to insure the obese. It's only recently that Medicare even classified obesity as a disease because there's just not enough money in the system to be able to take care of all the obesity-related pathologies. And, of course, it also allows big food to absolve themselves of any responsibility because, after all, it's the patient's fault. There is another way of interpreting the first law, and that is to put the weight gain first. In other words, if you're going to store it and you expect to burn it, then you're going to have to eat it. Now, all of a sudden, those pathological behaviors can actually be subservient to a biochemical process that's going on in the brain. That process is tantamount to starvation. It's exactly what happens in starvation.
It's excess sugar that makes the brain thinks it's starving.
Excess insulin that makes the brain thinks it's starving. And actually, the Chronicle over the weekend published an article about this hypothesis, but basically took all the words insulin and turned them to sugar. Now, it's true that sugar is the primary stimulus for insulin. That's true. But there are many, many others, and there are other things that make your insulin go up. Those things were sort of glossed over. For instance, fiber lowers insulin, so lack of fiber raises it. And there's basically no fiber in our diet today. I've talked to anthropological nutritionists who tell me that in the old days, humans used to eat 100 to 300 grams of fiber per day. Now they eat less than 10. So that's a very significant change in our diet. The question is, why is there no fiber in our diet? Well, the answer is because you can't freeze fiber. Try taking an orange.
Fruit processing takes out the fiber.
Absolutely. Think about orange juice. Okay, oranges depreciate on the shelf, whereas orange juice, you squeeze it, you freeze it, it's forever. It becomes very cheap. The impetus to provide cheap food, which came as a function of the Johnson administration in its combating poverty, has basically kept the food prices low on purpose. But in order to do that, big food had to find ways of increasing shelf life. And the way they did it was to take away fiber. So they've added sugar for various reasons, which I'm sure we'll discuss, and they've taken away fiber. And those two things together probably form the cornerstone of what's going on in our brains in terms of how the insulin goes up and how that insulin blocks other hormones that would normally tell us we're full. And that's the concept of starvation that's going on even if you're obese.
So you, as an obesity researcher, are right there with people like Mary Nestle and Michael Pollan and others who have been continuing to talk. Well, you're talking also about kind of an addiction. I mean, this is, to you, like a nicotine addiction, sugar, isn't it?
Absolutely. In fact, there's an area of the brain called the nucleus accumbens, which is where nicotine and morphine work. It all has to do with a neurotransmitter called dopamine. The more dopamine, the more reward. Food intake is a readout of reward. If you put morphine into the nucleus accumbens, you get increased food intake in animals. Normally, when your body is what we call insulin sensitive, that is at low insulin levels and your body's working properly, insulin normally clears dopamine. So the dopamine goes away, which actually decreases the reward of food. And it's thought that that's one of the processes by which you stop eating after a meal is over. Your insulin rises, your dopamine goes down. That's the end of the meal. However, if your insulin's high, as what we have right now in terms of our new culture, if you will, it can't clear the dopamine when your insulin's high. Your brain becomes insulin resistant. It can't clear the dopamine. The dopamine goes up, and therefore the reward of food is fostered, and it causes continued eating. In fact, the same as any other addiction, through the same exact mechanism.
Which is why you tell us, go back to the future, right, as far as eating, right? Go back to the 50s and the way we ate back then?
Right. I did a TV interview with Bob McKenzie from KTVU on Friday, and he heard this whole story. He said, what you're proposing is revolutionary. I said, no, it's reactionary. It's retro. It's going back to the way things were in the 50s before big food changed our diet for us.
So insulin really causes weight gain, and then there's this hormone leptin that plays a whole part in the...
Right. Leptin is really sort of the signal hormone for energy sufficiency. Leptin is made by our fat cells, and our fat cells communicate with the brain through leptin to tell your brain how much fat you have on board. When your energy replete, that is, you have enough energy on board to engage in normal metabolic processes, your leptin tells your brain what's going on, and your brain interprets that so that you can burn energy at a normal rate. And when you burn energy at a normal rate, you feel good. But if something's interfering with that leptin signal, and that leptin signal can't get through, then your brain sees starvation. So let me try to explain this in simple terms for the audience. Let's take you, Mr. Krasny. You're a nice, thin guy.
Nice of you to say. Okay. Untrue, by the way, I should say for listeners.
Each of us has a personal...
Nice is not true. It's true, but not thin, yeah.
Each of us has a personal leptin threshold, below which our brain sees starvation. Let's say yours is 20. So if your leptin is 20, 21, 22, 168, 585, it doesn't matter. Your brain sees that it's above 20, and so you're going to burn energy at a normal rate, which happens to be 50 calories per kilo fat-free mass. That's the identity number. Now, let's say you try to diet, and you bring your leptin from 20 down to 19. Your brain's going to see that drop in leptin below that threshold of 20 down to 19 as starvation. What's going to happen is that your brain is going to send signals through your what's called your autonomic nervous system, which happens to compose of two separate portions of your nervous system, one called the sympathetic nervous system, which normally burns energy, and the other one called the vagus nerve, which normally stores energy. That leptin signal that has been depleted is going to tell your brain to put those two systems into operation in order to conserve energy and to try to store more. That's starvation. That is the starvation response. So when your sympathetic goes down and your vagus goes up, basically you turn into an energy storage machine. And what's going to happen is you're going to store more energy and your leptin will go back up to 20. That's the recidivism of obesity, by the way, is that
that's
leptin.
That's why diets don't work.
Why diets essentially don't work is because your body's trying to reclaim where it was. Now, let's take me. I happen to be a little on the heavy side. I wish I weren't, but that's the way it is. Let's say my leptin is 80. Now, my personal leptin threshold is also 20, just like yours, but my leptin is 80. However, my 80 is being read as a 20. Now, let's say I try to diet, and I bring my leptin from 80 down to 75. My brain won't see 80 going down to 75. My brain will see 20 going down to 19 is what's going to happen. And so I will basically engage in the starvation response also in an attempt to bring my leptin back up to 80 so it can be read as a 20. This phenomenon of not being able to see the leptin signal is a phenomenon that we scientists call leptin resistance, the inability to see that leptin signal. And that has occupied basically all of endocrinology for the last 10 years
because is trying to understand so much
that.
More ubiquitous. Yeah.
Exactly. Is what is that leptin resistance? The hypothesis, based on work that I've done and also work that many other people have done, is that that signal from leptin is being interfered with by your insulin. Now, the question is, why would God do that to us? What is the adaptive advantage? Whenever we see this kind of thing in science or in medicine, there's always an adaptive advantage. For instance, blacks have increased sickle cell disease. Why? The reason is because the sickle cell trait, that is having one gene that has the sickle gene on it, actually protects you from malaria. So there's always an adaptive advantage when you see this kind of phenomenon. So what's the adaptive advantage of having your insulin block your leptin? And the answer is two things, puberty and pregnancy, both of which make your insulin go up in order to make you gain weight, because if we didn't gain weight during puberty or pregnancy, the species would die out. So this is actually a method for being able to ensure reproduction. Absolutely. It's totally Darwinian. The point is our insulin is supposed to be down except during puberty and pregnancy, and now it's up all the time.
Talking to Dr. Robert Lustig, who is a pediatric researcher at the University of California, San Francisco Medical School, our environment makes our insulin high all the time. In fact, you don't use the language, but Kelly Brownell talks about toxic environment, by which he means exactly that. And yet, you can see that there's been some disagreement on a number of things with your hypothesis. One is the effect of insulin and the idea that this is fairly speculative.
Right. There's no question that this is a hypothesis, and I specifically say so, and I will say for the audience that this, at this point in time, is just a hypothesis. We are actually designing basic science experiments.
Can you do more animal models?
It. Yes, we're in the process of trying to do that right now. The question is, what does insulin actually do in the brain? One of the reasons that this has been so cryptic, so difficult to sort of ferret out, is because if you look at the studies where you inject insulin directly into the brain acutely, that is one injection, it actually stops food intake. So the concept that insulin actually is a negative regulator of food intake is what's in the books. However, it's not about the acute phenomenon. It's about the chronic phenomenon. Almost every hormone that we have in our body has an acute effect and a different chronic effect. An example would be cortisol, where cortisol is the stress hormone. You need it in order to be able to respond to any sort of stress like an infection or a car accident. But if you have chronic cortisol, you get depression, you get ulcers, you get weight gain, all different from the acute effect. Insulin's the same thing. You get one effect in the acute situation and you get a different effect in the chronic situation. That actually has been sort of covered up, even though those studies from the early 80s where they injected insulin chronically into the brain actually support that. But people have forgotten about it. We're trying to bring that back.
You're also bringing back the idea that perhaps people are victims, that maybe they don't have enough choice. In fact, that willpower, which has always been held in high esteem when it comes to reducing weight, because of that first law of thermodynamics, going back to that, you know, you can give up sloth and gluttony just through sheer willpower, that somehow, for example, when you talk about government fiat taking sugar out of foods, you realize, you know, that you're ruffling lots of feathers.
People
don't like that kind of government, notion that government ought to play that role. But just the idea also that people are, that everybody's a victim somehow, their brain chemistry.
Well, and of course, this is one of the major criticisms of this whole concept is, you know, how can you basically label every obese person a victim? Look, I don't claim to know a tremendous amount about adult obesity. Maybe there are adults who are obese who are actually happy about it and choose to be obese. But I'm a pediatrician, and I can tell you categorically without question that there is no child in this entire world who wants to be obese. Children are ostracized from their peers when they're obese. The children won't play with them. And their quality of life has actually been shown by Dr. Jeff Schwimmer at UC San Diego to be consistent and at the same level as a kid on cancer chemotherapy. In addition, the rate of prevalence of obesity has gone up fastest and highest in the 2 to 5 year old. Now, the 2 to 5 year old cannot possibly accept personal responsibility, and the 2 to 5 year old also doesn't decide what he or she is going to eat. So the concept of personal responsibility falls apart when you're talking about children. Now,
well, you do some work with farm workers in Salinas. You have a clinic there, and you have seen just about 100% obesity.
Basically 100% obesity. It's all itinerant farm workers, basically no English, and the kids are massively obese. And I'll just tell you a quick clinical vignette about one patient that sort of proves the point. I'm seeing this one kid. He's 6 years old, and he weighs 100 pounds. He's wider than he is tall. And I'm taking the history from the mother in Spanish. I did my standard history. I don't care what your kid eats. Tell me what he drinks. No soda, surprisingly, but a gallon of orange juice a day. A gallon. So I'm explaining to them, I do the math on this, and a gallon of orange juice a day would be worth 112 pounds of fat per year. So clearly, this is where the energy excess is coming from to cause this kid's obesity. And I know that this is because of the insulin. And we know that ultimately, you outgrow your insulin supply, and that's going to lead to type 2 diabetes, which now is half of all adult Latinos. So I see what's happening here, and we've got to do something about it. So I tell the mother, in Spanish, la fruta es bueno, los jugos es malo, the fruit is good, the juice is bad, the fruit has fiber, the juice doesn't, the fruit has 20 calories, the juice has 120 calories.
But the juice also has nutrients, right?
So does the fruit. So does the fruit. The only nutrient that the juice has is, number one, the sucrose, and number two, the vitamin C. Well, the fruit has that too. The question is, do you need 120 calories with no fiber? How many oranges can you eat in a sitting? One. So there's 20 calories. How many glasses of orange juice can you drink in a sitting? Quite a few. So there's a problem here. So I'm explaining this to the mother, and she says to me the most prescient thing that any mother has ever said to me in my 25 years as a pediatrician. She has changed me from an obesity researcher to an obesity activist with one sentence. She said, then why does WIC give it to us? Now, WIC is Women, Infants, Children. This is a government entitlement program set up by the U.S. Department of Agriculture after World War II to prevent failure to thrive. They did. As with any government policy, this is the equal and opposite reaction. Therefore, yes, it is the toxic environment. Yes, it is government playing into it. Probably, I'm sure it's unbeknownst to them. I'm sure it's not in a malicious way. I don't even think Big Food is doing it in a malicious way. The point is, though, that there is clearly a problem with our food supply. And if you don't have a choice, for instance, if you're on WIC, and you can't get fruit, you can only get fruit juice on WIC, then it's not about fault.
I think
it's
that maybe, for example, the food stamp is being only used for fresh for juice rather than fresh fruit may be in the process of changing if it hasn't already changed.
Well, in California, welfare. There's welfare and there's WIC, and those are two different things.
No, I'm talking about welfare now.
Right.
Yeah.
Welfare, you can get fruit on food stamps.
Right.
But with WIC, until recently in California, it was all just juice, no fruit. California WIC has actually bucked the national trend and has actually put in some, they've changed it, but the rest of the country has not.
Let me get back to your hypothesis, though, because it really is fascinating. And yet, you may have seen the Sunday New York Times. There was a whole article on obesity, and they were talking largely about adult obesity, but they're talking about gut microflora, this bacteria that gets in the stomach, and androviruses, which we once did a whole program on, somebody who thought the etiology of so many diseases was related to androviruses. Mm-hmm. And then you've got nutrigenomics now suggesting that there's a variation of metabolism among different people, so you vary the diet. Mm-hmm. I mean, lots of things in this, not to mention the fact that a lot of kids are idle and a lot of kids are just eating.
Well, the point is that the idleness has to do with the fact that their body's in energy storage mode. So that makes actual sense. The reason
these thoughts about bacteria, for example?
Well, I'll get to the bacteria in a second, but let me address your question about the idleness first. Yes, kids are not exercising like they should. You put a treadmill in front of the TV and say, look, you watch the TV, walk on the treadmill, the kid doesn't. Okay? What is it about sloth? Well, here's what it's about. It's about whether you're in energy storage mode or not. Let me explain. You eat 2,000 calories a day. You burn 2,000 calories a day. You feel good. It's a normal day. Are you going to gain weight, lose weight, or stay the same? You stay the same. Because you burn what you eat, there's nothing to store. Now let's raise your insulin fivefold, okay, to the level of these obese kids that are walking around today, fivefold. You start out the day now eating 2,000 calories, but now, because of the excess insulin your body is now exposed to that it wasn't before, 500 of those calories, whoosh, straight off to fat, like what the IRS does to your paycheck. Gone before you ever had a chance to spend it, gone before you ever had a chance to burn it. You are now 500 calories heavier, whether you like it or not. Now, you ate 2,000 calories a day, but you lost 500 to your fat. How many calories do you have left to burn? 1,500. But your body wants to burn 2,000 because that's when it feels good. In fact, the number of calories that you have available to burn dictates your quality of life. So what do we call the state where your body has fewer calories than it wants to burn? It's called starvation. That's what starvation is. So how do you feel when you're starved? Crappy, tired, slothy, sit on the couch, don't want to do anything, certainly don't want to exercise, and of course, hungry. So in a world of free access to food, what are you going to do? You're going to eat back the 500. So now you're up to 2,500.
You're watching a video game rather than being on a treadmill.
Absolutely.
Watching television.
Yeah. Absolutely. So what are you going to do? You're going to eat back the 500. So now you're up to 2,500 instead of 2,000, except your insulin's still high. So 100 of those 500, whoosh, off the fat. Now you're 600 calories heavier. You only have 1,900 to burn. You still don't feel quite right. So you go to a doctor. You go to a nutritionist. You say, Doc, why am I fat? And the doctor says, well, I know what you're fat. You're an overeater. You eat 2,500 calories and you ought to be eating 2,000. And it's true. You are an overeater now and a sloth. But it's not because you chose to. It's not because you want to. It's because you have to. It's a drive that was set up by the high insulin, which I did to you experimentally, and which, unfortunately, the toxic environment is doing to our kids through standard nutrition.
So what do we do about this? You want the government to play a stronger role, obviously in education and not only educating the public but providing healthy food options. What about, you know, things like banning soft drinks from kids, as I alluded to before then?
Well, we banned tobacco. In fact, this is the exact same fight we had with tobacco, and it's with the same people. If you think about it, who is Altria? Okay, Altria is Philip Morris. And what does Altria own? Kraft General Foods and Nabisco. Okay, you're looking at all of the processed foods, and you're looking at the excess sugar and the excess salt that's put in them. Then you look at the soft drink companies, okay? And I won't mention a specific soft drink company for fear of libel and retribution, but let's look at a standard soft drink that you pull off the shelf, okay? Can has 12 ounces, 150 calories, right? What else is in that soft drink? Well, first thing, caffeine. Now, what does caffeine do? Well, it gives you a little bit of a buzz, but mostly what caffeine is a diuretic. It actually makes you urinate water. So you lose water when you drink a soft drink because of the diuretic effect of the caffeine. So you become mildly dehydrated. What else is in soft drinks? Salt, sodium, 55 milligrams per can. It's like drinking a pizza. So what happens if you lose water and take on salt? You become thirstier. Of course, that means you'll drink another one. So why is there so much sugar in soft drinks? To hide the salt. When was the last time you went to a Chinese restaurant and had sweet and sour pork? Can you taste that that's half soy sauce? No, because your tongue is fooled by the sugar into not seeing the salt. This is a well-known dietary, culinary effect, is basically add sugar to get rid of the salt.
Then you have people like me who have given up soft drinks, gone over to Calistoga, and now are taking in that much more salt probably, or just as much salt.
No, there's a whole lot less salt in Calistoga.
No, I know, but still, a lot of salt. Actually, I'm going to open up the phone lines and invite those of you listening to join us in this conversation, an opportunity for you to talk to Dr. Lustig about his hypothesis or about obesity. If you have a question or comment, join us now. Toll free, 866-733-6786. Again, lines available to you, and you're cordially invited to join us at 866-733-6786 or by email. And the email address here is forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Dr. Robert Lustig, who is a pediatric researcher at the University of California, San Francisco Medical School, who has come out essentially with a hypothesis that appeared in Nature Clinical Practice, Endocrinology and Metabolism, and it's based on obesity studies that were done on children. And the hypothesis is essentially that insulin and leptin play a kind of biochemical role in making us feel as if we're starving, and children feel as if we're starving because of the food that's given to them. And It's often processed food, and it's often fiberless food, and so we need to think really much more about diet and about the food that is being manufactured and processed and all that. I'm going to go to your phone calls in just a moment. We were talking about food fights off air here. I mean, these are major, and these are coming up and are imminent. That is to say, those who would like to curb the food industry and have some kind of prevailing sense of maybe the food industry making not only at least everything available in the way of what's in what we're eating, including in restaurants, but also putting some restraints.
Well, you know, it's kind of silly for us to have allowed the food industry to sort of dictate our diet for us. They've made mistakes in the past, as I'm sure you're aware. Probably the most glaring one was when, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, when canning started, all the cans had lead in them. So, you know, it's not always so smart to let your big food
Well, that's why we have government agencies to check them and to monitor them and be vigilant about what they're
doing. Well, that's the problem, and that's one of the things that the food companies use as a retort, is fructose, which is the half of sucrose, which, of course, is the main ingredient in high-fructose corn syrup, which has basically supplanted sucrose because it's cheaper to produce. They're saying, well, fructose is a nutrient. After all, it's fruit sugar. The problem is that fructose is not metabolized like fruit sugar. The fructose is actually metabolized like fat. It's actually metabolized like alcohol. It's essentially the same as alcohol without the buzz.
You know, we've got a question here. We're right on point here, I think. Chris from Palo Alto, good morning.
Hi. Actually, the doctor just answered my question about the difference in how sucrose and fructose are metabolized and the effect that that has on insulin.
That's a very good question and absolutely essential to the point. Fructose, it enters the liver cell without insulin regulation, and it goes right down a pathway to form a metabolite in the liver called acetyl-CoA. Now, acetyl-CoA is normally metabolized by your Krebs cycle, which is what really generates the most energy inside the liver cell. And that ultimately breaks it down to carbon dioxide and water, which you get rid of. The problem is, what happens if your excess acetyl-CoA builds up to such a level that your Krebs cycle can't metabolize all of it? And that's what happens when you take a big fructose meal, like a soda. There are three things that can happen to excess acetyl-CoA. The first is it can dimerize. Two acetyl-CoAs can bind together to form something called malonyl-CoA, which has actually been shown to be toxic in the pancreatic beta cell. And some people think that's the cause of type 2 diabetes. The other thing that can happen is it can be built up as two carbon fragments into what we call free fatty acids and then exported out to be either become atherogenic or to serve as a substrate for obesity at the level of the fat cell. And then the third thing that can happen is that the fat can actually precipitate in the liver, causing something called non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. We've actually had one patient at UCSF who required a liver transplant at age 15 because he developed cirrhosis from drinking sodas.
You know, Nancy Asher did the transplant?
Yes.
Okay. Friend. Jason, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. I'm live in San Francisco, and my son is just about to turn 4, and he's actually not obese. He's pretty skinny, like me, but he is addicted to sugar. He's really picky, and we're really having a lot of trouble getting to eat anything that is sugar, like applesauce and raisins and snack foods are what he likes, and he turns his nose up. Like today, he wanted to eat honey, but I made him eat bread with the honey, so he refused it. He wouldn't eat the bread.
Good for you.
You know, he wouldn't eat even to get the honey. He would not eat bread. So, you know, and he was in a crabby mood. So, like, that's what struck a nerve when you were saying that the starvation sort of makes the behavior kind of unpleasant.
You're bringing up an important point, Jason. That is how you get kids off sugar. I mean, as a pediatrician, you face this all the time, I'm sure.
We do. You know, one of the things that has, you know, been sort of bandied about in the literature is this concept that sugar makes kids hyperactive also. And there are several books about it. Well, in fact, it's not that they become hyperactive. It's that they actually fidget. And one of the reasons they fidget is because when you supply the sugar and you raise your leptin, that's your sympathetic nervous system acting on your muscles to actually make you get rid of it. So here we are giving Ritalin to kids to actually stop the fidgeting when actually what we had to do was change the diet. The bottom line for you, sir, is that this is an extraordinarily complex problem, and I'm not going to be able to tell you that I have the key to answering it. But what I can say is when your child's brain thinks it's not getting enough calories, it will take in whatever it needs to. And what I would do is I would try to limit the sugar as much as possible, and if he cries, so be it. He's going to have to get off this some point. You know, you're going to have 3 days probably of, you know, massive temper tantrums, but ultimately it will work to your child.
They don't have rehab for kids with sugar addiction.
Yeah, well, that would be smart.
Cold turkey or something. Jason, I'm sorry, what were you saying?
I was just saying we're having the temper tantrums anyway, so that doesn't seem so bad.
Well, even more reason to get rid of it now.
Yeah, good luck with it, and thank you for your call. We'll go to more of your calls here forthwith. In fact, let's get Elliot on. Morning.
Hi. I'm glad I had the opportunity to hear this discussion this morning. I don't know if the doctor was pleased with the article that came out in the Chronicle this weekend, but I read it, and he sounded somewhat like a crank. And so I guess I wonder whether he was pleased, and what are the main talking points, or what are the main points that he would have wanted that article to make, rather than the idea that came through to me in the article is, here's a doctor who says it's not your fault that you're fat.
Well, first of all, you've already made the point that sugar was used too much rather than insulin.
Right.
But what else?
Right. I was not actually happy with the Chronicle's article. I was allowed to review my quotes, but I wasn't allowed to review the copy on the article before its publication.
That's standard, though. Yeah.
That is standard. I do believe that if you are in this vicious cycle of high insulin, leptin resistance, and therefore continued overeating, that ultimately you can't get out of it on your own. I do believe that. So in that respect, I do believe it's not your fault. I also believe that there are hidden sugars that are put in almost everything we eat. For instance, hamburger buns. Why is there high fructose corn syrup in hamburger buns? Why is the first ingredient in the barbecue sauce high fructose corn syrup? Where did this come from? This wasn't around in 1950 or 1960. So when you talk about the food supply and the fact that you have choice, in fact, if you're eating processed foods, you don't have a lot of choice. And unfortunately, most of the populace who cannot afford to eat organic or eat, you know, or you know, really choose their foods, and in fact are ultimately eating at fast food restaurants because it's the only clean, air-conditioned place in their local community, you know, they ultimately don't have a choice. And when you're in this, you know, spiraling
vicious
cycle. You get
hamburger buns, you can look at the ingredients on the hamburger buns and see what kind of fructose is in there, and then make your choice, can't
you? Well, in fact, only if you educate people about what it means, and that's what we're trying to do. Dr. Hill, who responded to that article saying, yes, he'd like to fix the toxic environment, but ultimately, you know, he wants everybody to exercise. He also agrees that, you know, these things are out there, and what we have to do is we have to educate people about what's going on. So,
Wouldn't it be better to educate people than to put manacles on?
To be honest with you, I think we have to do both. And the best way to do that is to educate the politicians about what's actually going on so that they can help us. They did it with tobacco. In fact, it's the same fight.
We'll go to more of your calls, and we'll go next to Steve. Hi.
Great show. It's not only the children that need the withdrawal, it's also the adults, because I think I try to go today only. I will not eat a brownie from Specialties. So if that's it's like a next step type of program or being in AA. I took a great class with Dr. Bob Barron from UCSF. Great class, and it was with the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. Doctor, would you please talk about, apart from the chemicals or the taste, is a calorie of chocolate the same as a calorie of salad or lettuce, but the density is what is the difference. If I ate a big bar of chocolate, I could get 1,000 calories out of that, or I could eat salad all day long, not get 1,000 calories.
Right. That's a very good question. If you talk to a nutritionist, a standard RD, they will tell you a calorie is a calorie. And in fact, I don't really believe that. I believe that it depends on where the calorie came from, because the calorie represents a specific insulin response based on what else the calorie came with. In other words, if you eat that calorie with high fiber, it's going to reduce your insulin response. And the lower you can keep your insulin, the less likely you are to shunt sugar to fat.
Well, that seems so transparently obvious. How can nutritionists argue that a calorie is a calorie?
Well, because it's just the standard interpretation of the first law. They're assuming that what you eat and what you burn are fixed and that they're not negotiable. But the fact of the matter is they are very negotiable, because what you burn is very much dependent on whether your brain thinks you're starved.
How much of this whole problem has to do really with metabolism? It seems to me that that's part of the mystery when we talk about weight and obesity in children, or just what comes through in our DNA. Our temperament seems to be related to our metabolism. Our metabolism seems to affect what we eat and how we eat.
Absolutely. That's exactly what this is. This is the interaction between our environment and our biochemistry. My contribution to this debate is ultimately eliciting the mechanism by which our environment alters our biochemistry. Up till now, we've only had associations between, say, fast food, soft drinks, processed foods, and obesity, all of the epidemiologic studies, but there was no proof in terms of causation. This actually gives us a mechanism by which we can understand how those changes in environment ultimately impact on our biochemistry. This is not a new idea that this can happen. An example, rickets. Rickets in children. If you don't get enough vitamin D, it alters your bones. In fact, we know that it's because of the vitamin D that you take from the outside, which actually affects your hormones on the inside, that you actually build strong bones instead of bow legs. So the concept that what you eat and what happens inside your body is not a new idea. I am just taking it to the next step in terms of energy balance.
I don't know if this is true. Maybe one of the listeners can tell me, but a long time ago I read that the somewhat pejorative use of the word limey to describe Brits goes back to their sailor days when they ate limes to avoid rickets.
Absolutely. Well, no, to avoid scurvy.
Also there were such problems with rickets that they would change their diet in other ways, and yet the focus was on the lime for some reason.
Well, no, lime has to do with scurvy, and scurvy has to do with connective tissue, so their teeth would fall out. It wasn't actually causing rickets. Rickets is a vitamin D condition, so it's a slightly different condition. But we certainly see it in kids. As an example, breastfeeding kids who are exclusively breastfed ultimately develop rickets, and the reason is because breast milk doesn't have vitamin D in it. It doesn't have iron. It also doesn't have fluoride in it. So even though the La Leche League says that breast milk is the world's perfect food for babies, in fact, supplementation with iron, fluoride, and vitamin D is essential. So, and why? Because it actually affects your hormones if you don't. This is another example of that.
And we'll get another caller on the air with us, and that's you, Nadine. Good morning.
Hi. I'm so happy you're on today because it was a very interesting article. And I know a number of years ago that on KQED you had Dr. Wheel one night, and he was talking about the alarming information about high fructose corn syrup. And over the last 10 years now, of course, it's just everywhere. And even someone like me who reads and listens and learns and tries to keep it out of my house, instead I just have, you know, barbecue sauce from Trader Joe's that has sugar in it. And we're still all completely addicted to sugar, me number one, but we're all very skinny. I guess we're just lucky. But what I want to know is, what would a diet look like that wasn't toxic according to your theory? Because I would love to try it out because I get a kind of a gut sense that a lot of this stuff is really, truly bad.
Okay. First of all, let me make a comment. You brought up the high fructose corn syrup issue and also sugar. In fact, high fructose corn syrup is 55% fructose. Sucrose or table sugar is 50% fructose. I don't actually make a difference or a distinction between the two in terms of their metabolism. They're equally bad. The problem is that high fructose corn syrup is cheaper, therefore it's become more ubiquitous. I was assailed by the Beverage Association because of this, and the Corn Refiners Association because of this. I don't have a specific beef with high fructose corn syrup per se. I have a beef with what it does to our insulin and the fomenting of insulin resistance and the fact that it's so much cheaper that it's basically been put in every food, whether we need it there or not. Now, in terms of what the diet should look like, basically, the higher you can get the fiber, the better off you are. Because the higher the fiber, the lower the energy density, the lower the amount of sugar, the lower the insulin response. There's also data that, Mr. Krasny, you had asked me about the gut flora and this whole bioenergetics.
That was in the Sunday New York Times.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It turns out that the higher the fiber, the more the gut flora generates something called short-chain fatty acids, like butyrate and propionate. And it turns out that those actually inhibit insulin secretion. So the long-chain fatty acids stimulate it, the short chains inhibit it, and anything you can do to inhibit your insulin ultimately is a good thing. So the higher the fiber you can go, the better off you are. Dr.
Can
Linda,
you get addicted to fiber? Like,
no, I don't think so. Dr. Linda Frasetto at the University of California, San Francisco Adult Nephrology Division is doing a study right now looking at what she calls the Paleolithic diet. So basically, this is a diet that has basically become, you know, just completely organic and has absolutely no additives whatsoever. And not only is it helping in terms of weight maintenance, but it's also helping in terms of reversing all of the cardiovascular comorbidities that you can look at. So I think that basically what we need to do is we need to get the fructose out of our diet, whether it's being high fructose corn syrup or sucrose, and get the fiber up. I would say that those are probably the two main cornerstones to fixing our food supply. Problem is, big food doesn't like either of those.
And it's a big lobby.
It's a very big lobby.
We've got some listeners who asked some direct questions by email. Here's one listener, Sujatha, who says, it's amazing to listen to a good doctor. I'm a 40-year-old diabetic woman who has yo-yo dieted all her life as a fat child, fat adolescent, and fat adult. Finally, when I turned 40 this year, I decided to regulate my weight by hiring a personal trainer and a regimen of walking. I am 25 pounds lighter. Never imagined I could get rid of weight without cosmetic surgery. When the doctor told me to lose 30 pounds before going for liposuction, I was like, then why would I need liposuction? Anyway, my question is, how do I get the high fructose corn syrup out of my diet? It's in everything.
I don't know. That's what politicians are for. Ultimately, we have to educate the politicians as to the folly of what we've done to our food supply. We've done it previously. We did it with tobacco. We got tobacco out of kids' hands. We can do it with soft drinks and with getting rid of high fructose corn syrup. I suggest to the Iowa farmers who are making the high fructose corn syrup that they basically turn the corn into ethanol and try to solve our energy crisis. That way, they won't be out anything. If anything, they'll be helping the country, and they'll help be curing obesity. Unfortunately, Archer Daniels Midland probably is not too happy with that idea right now.
Here's another listener who says, is fiber bought from a health food store okay to take every day in addition to fruits and vegetables? And which is more important, soluble or insoluble fiber or oat bran?
Probably it doesn't matter. Soluble fiber and insoluble fiber seem to be equally efficacious in terms of keeping your insulin down. I don't think that there's a big difference between the two. What we try to teach our children in our weight assessment for teen and child health clinic at UCSF, also known as the Watch Clinic, and I'm only the director of that. I have a wonderful staff of people, Dr. Andrea Garber, our pediatric nutritionist, Dr. Michelle Mita-Snyder, our preventative pediatric cardiologist. We have a clinical psychologist, Dr. Joan Valenti. We have a wonderful staff that basically tries to get the insulin down any way you can. And we do that through numerous mechanisms. But one of the things that we espouse in that is that when you eat a solid food, you should look at the side of the package. One of the nice things about what's happened over the last 10 years are the food labels. Look at where it says dietary fiber. If that number is 3 grams or greater, then that's good. If it's 2 grams or less, that's just not enough to make a difference in terms of your insulin. So keep the fiber content up by 3 grams or greater, and if it's a liquid, then 5 calories or less. 6 or more, leave at the store.
Getting an incredible number of emails here, many of them asking questions. I hope we can get to some more of them. This is from a local famous lawyer who writes, last Monday, USDA issued a proposed rule to change the WIC program by including fruits, vegetables, and whole grains and decreasing eggs, milk, and fruit juice. So
that would be
that's
wonderful.
Just for the record.
Good.
And meantime, let me get more of your calls. Janelle, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have noticed that there are a lot of children that don't eat quite, the raw vegetables, and they tend to be, heavier set, but they grow up to be adults that have a lot of obesity issues and are very insecure about themselves, but also low amounts of serotonin. And I was wondering how we can teach children to eat more appropriately and prevent, this occurrence in adults.
Well, you make a very good point that if you're obese as a child, the probability of becoming an obese adult is 90%. So, the idea of baby fat coming off is basically a myth. In fact, we know that at 4 months, if you're obese, the chances that you'll be obese at 7 years are 90%, and if you're obese at 7 years, the chances are 90% that you'll be obese as an adult. And in fact, Dr. Matt Gilman just this past week published a paper in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition showing that six-month-olds today are now heavier than six-month-olds were just 20 years ago. So this problem is even starting as early as birth. So that's a big issue. I want to make another. So how do you do that? Well, the best way, I think, is to set an example, because kids basically learn how to eat from what their parents eat. I don't know how to train the parents to do different other than to educate them, which is what I'm trying to do right now. I also want to make one other comment before we end up, calling this a wrap. Big food is doing its best to try to influence this debate in various ways. I want to mention one particular state bill here in California, State Bill 281. This was a bill that was allocated $6 million to give fresh fruits and vegetables to kids in schools. And Big Food actually lobbied the legislators in Sacramento to change the word fresh to nutritious. So this means canned fruit and syrup and all sorts of other packaged processed goods. So they know what's going on, and they're doing their best to try to undo the good work that everyone else is trying to propagate.
Of course, now there's been legislation that changes the kind of fast foods that were once available, school lunches, and once, in fact, a part of almost all lunches. Like you say, the key to a lot of this is through politics and through legislation.
Well, let me mention that, too, because you know that Clinton and Huckabee went to the soft drink companies and got them to voluntarily not supply soft drinks to elementary and middle schools. Well, there's a reason why they were successful in doing that. And that's because the soft drink companies own the juice and the sports drinks companies, and all they're going to do is substitute one bad liquid for another. They're not out anything. All they get to do is substitute, and they also get to not be monitored by any a government agency by doing it voluntarily.
Looks like a pretty good deal for a couple of Arkansians, though.
I think it's useless.
I
think it's useless.
I hear you. Okay, back to the emails for a moment. A number of people have asked about milk and the effect of milk on children. Concern about allergies, concern about what's in milk?
Well, you're not supposed to give cow's milk until 12 months of age. That usually reduces the chance for allergy. We suggest in our clinic that it's breast milk till 12 months. Then it's whole milk from 12 to 24 months, and the reason is because you need the fatty acids for normal brain development. And then after 2 years of age, the best thing to do is go to skim milk. You need the vitamin D, you need the calcium, you need the phosphorus. We're all for dairy, we're all for milk. But you don't need the fat in milk. You need the other things in order to build good bones and have appropriate muscles. And also there's some data that suggests that high calcium intake actually reduces obesity through effects on the adipocyte. So there are lots and lots of good reasons to drink milk. I am totally for milk. We as human beings were designed to drink milk and water, and that's it.
Aaron, join us. You're on.
Hi. I have a question for you. First of all, I'd like to say that I really appreciate the information that you've been studying and whatnot. My only question was: what kind of responsibility do you put on the parents and the individuals who are obese? A lot of this sounds like you're really putting it on the majority of the food companies, which I really believe it is. But I also believe that there's a great deal of responsibility for the individual. Do you agree with me?
Ultimately, we have to educate everyone. I'm not in any way saying that it's okay to let your child eat whatever they want because it's the food company's fault. Ultimately, we have to have a grassroots campaign in this country where we educate parents, we educate community leaders, we educate politicians, ultimately educate Big Food about what they're doing. In the same way we did with tobacco.
I thought you said they knew what they were doing.
Well, they do know what they're doing in terms of selling more food. Remember that the food industry in this country manufactures 3,800 calories per capita per day. We can only eat 1,800 calories per capita per day. That means they are making more than double what we can actually consume. Somebody has to be the vessel by which all of this excess food gets removed. Unfortunately, the vessel is us.
It's the supersize me again.
Absolutely.
You love this email. It's from a listener. Says, hi there, I'm only 11, but I have been listening to your show for 2 years, which I love, and I like it a lot. Mr. Lustig, I find that your work with obesity is very interesting, and I have learned many things because of your being on this show. Thank you so much. I find that we need more people like you in this day and age. And Mr. Krasny, keep on bringing people like Mr. Robert Lustig on your show. Camille.
Well, thank you very much, Camille. And I
this is not your progeny, is it?
Not at all.
All right. She writes very clearly, actually, and to be congratulated on that.
That made my day.
Well, here's a couple of people also who want you to make their day. Email from Jeff in Houston, Texas, and from Jennifer locally, and a number of others just asking recommendations on books, recommendations on where they can read more on this hypothesis.
Well, unfortunately, I don't know of any really good book that ties all of this together at the moment. I can refer people to specific books about specific issues. For instance, Kelly Brownell's Food Fight, which talks about the toxic environment. Marion Nestle's Food Politics, which talks about what big food gets out of this. Dr. David Ludwig, my colleague at Boston Children's, will have a book out next year, which I believe is tentatively titled Ending the Food Fight. There are several other books that have come out over the course of time.
You need to do one. You realize how many books you could have sold just being on this program today? Judging by our volume of email.
To be honest with you, I'm a scientist, not a pop culturist. I really don't want to be Dr. Phil.
Any ideas about all these lattes that are for sale now? I mean, since you were
They have 500 calories per frappuccino. You know, lattes, if you keep the sugar out, aren't necessarily so bad because they have a little cream or a little skim milk. It's not that bad. It depends on how much sugar you put in them.
Dr. Lustig, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. I appreciate you having been with us.
My pleasure.
And Dr. Robert Lustig is a pediatric researcher at the University of California, San Francisco.
Children's Hospital.
Excuse me, Children's Hospital. We'll be back with you on the morrow. We're going to actually talk about kids tomorrow, indirectly and directly as well. We're going to look at some of these new video games, which have political and social content in them, and take up that whole subject. And I hope you'll join us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And you can always let us know about what you hear on Forum, what you think about what you hear on Forum, or what you'd like to hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call and response line at 415-553-3300. Forum is produced by Robin Giannatasio Mal, Hermione G, and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thank you again for being a part of this morning's program. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.